This week's guest is the incredibly talented guitarist, producer, and instructor, Kerry Too Smooth Marshall. After first realising that a music career was for him during his time in the military, Kerry went on to work with a number of well-known artists and has managed to build a very successful YouTube channel. All of which has ultimately led him to the creation of his most popular programme, Kerry's Camp. So the first question, it's always the same on this podcast, I feel like I'm repeating myself all the time, but I do like to ask everyone who does come on the podcast how they first got into doing what they do. So you are a guitarist. What is your background with that? How did you start playing?
So for me, I started out in church. In my church, everybody was like trying to play drums. I wasn't a very good drummer. So like the rotation for me was like I was like the last end of the drummer. So you might get like one or two things that happen. Like, you know, you might get a chance to play maybe once or twice. So I was like, I've always wanted to play guitar. I just never really knew how to do it. So there was a particular guy at my church that played that just saw that I took an interest, because every, you know, chance after service, I'd be like, hey, how, can you show me something? Can you show me something? And one day he was just like, fine, I'll show you something. So he showed me like three chords. I believe it was like a C chord and an A chord and an E chord. And I practiced them all the time. And so on Wednesday nights in my particular church that I grew up in, you just had the opportunity, like nobody would really, like none of the musicians really came on Wednesday nights. So I would kind of just sit in and kind of just doodle. And it just, I fell in love with it. So it was just one of those things where I just always wanted to play. Wasn't very good in the beginning, but just wanted to always kind of just be around it. So that was my like introduction into playing guitar, which is kind of just being at the right place at the right time. And when nobody else was available, I kind of just stepped up and just kind of occupied a space.
Yeah, the whole the whole church scene is crazy. I've never been to church personally, but like obviously being on Instagram and TikTok, church musicians are absolutely insane. Like you said, drummers particularly, they really stand out. Like when when I watch these videos, absolutely crazy. But I wanted to be, the first instrument I was drawn to was the drums. But I can't imagine picking that up now. I mean, as a bassist, you'd think like I definitely have the rhythm for it, but I don't know. I brought an electric kit and then it just sat downstairs and I literally never used it. So I was like, what is the point of having this?
Well, no, I understand. Like even now, like as a guitarist, because drums were like kind of my first love, I think I'm harder on drummer whenever I like pick a band. Like if the drummer does not lock, even though I can't do it, I know how it's supposed to feel. And if it doesn't feel that way, like, it's that, so like I tell drummers all the time, like when I first start a band or if I'm in a band, I'm like, man, I'm gonna be hard on you. Like it's nothing personal. It's just, it's like, because I know that you guys are the heartbeat and the drums don't hold down a specific like feeling, then the music just kind of just too loose sometimes, or it's not as tight as it needs to be, or it's too stiff, it's too rigid. So like, yeah, because I don't play drums effectively, I can't articulate and show. So sometimes like I'll do like the rhythm parts on my guitar to be like, I need it to feel like this, like make it feel like I totally get it. I totally understand.
Yeah, that's so funny. Like you saying that though, drums are like the key. Like even as a bassist, I'm saying this. Yeah. Like drums have to be, when if they're not where they are, you can tell straight away. Even just as someone who's listening in the audience, so I get that. Yeah. Did you have? This isn't something that I planned on asking you, but was there any musical influence in your family particularly? So is there anyone close to you that's played music?
That's a great question. My dad always had a bass around. He couldn't play. Like if you asked him to play, like just play a song, we, you know, if our lives were on the line, we all died because he could not play. but I remember he had like, I think it was his Redenbacher bass. It was red. It was a four string and like it was there at the house and like he would pick it up. This is back in the time when like 8-tracks were kind of like prominent during that time. So he put on his 8-track like Al Green and like would kind of like try to play along, but it wasn't enough for him to know like, oh, he knows what he's doing. I think it just was a hobby that he just enjoyed and wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So the music was always present in my house. It just wasn't there. Nobody really stood out. I was the first one to definitely be like, I want to be a musician. This is what I want to do. And then my brothers kind of followed in my footsteps.
Oh, nice. Are you the oldest then?
Yeah, I'm the oldest of four. Yeah.
Oh, nice. So what, did they pick up guitar as well or did they go onto different instruments?
So my middle brother, Joe, picked up drums. He's a very good drummer, but he also wanted to aspire to play bass. So he kind of dabbles in bass a little bit. Like he doesn't read. So he can, if I call out numbers, he can kind of follow along a little bit. So it's enough where we rehearse. he'll make you think that like he knows what he's doing because we've really rehearsed. But now if we like get on there and we call an audible and like switch up the song, he's gonna look at me like,
he's gonna be lost. Yeah,
right, exactly. But he's a phenomenal drummer. My baby brother David is an exceptional guitarist. But he's in corporate America, so like that's not his day job. So a lot of times when I have gigs that I can't do, if David is available, I will have him sub. And people be like, man, you were killing on the gig last week. I'm like, that wasn't me.
That's so funny. That do you look like as well? Do you get confused? The only difference
I've had, like my brother, like both of them are bald, so I have hair. So if they like wear a hat, we're good, because my youngest brother, we both wear glasses, so nobody would ever know. But they see the guitar and they're like, did you get a new guitar? And he really won't respond because we kind of use a lot of the same gear. Uh-huh. But yeah, he's super talented. Matter of fact, we have a show coming up in a couple weeks because we've done it before. But yeah, like he plays. My little sister like is more into fashion. She doesn't really necessarily like sing or do anything. But when we were growing up as kids, my mom used to make us all perform together. We kind of like were like a knockoff Jackson 5, if you will.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
What would she sing then, your sister in that?
Yeah, so my sister would sing, I would sing, like it was like we kind of all sang. I'm not a very good singer at all, like because you know, as you play, you're playing, you sing, it's like using both sides of your brain. So there would be certain times when I'm playing, I would look really remedial, like I just like I was having a glitch, because it's like either the song is going to come out or I'm going to play the chords. And because the way that I play as if someone is singing, cuz I do a lot of melodies in my chords. It would be really kind of challenging for me to kind of sing the song while I'm trying to play it. So you sometimes get one or the other, but yeah, so they are much better singers than I am, but I never really kind of tapped into it to kind of perfect it.
Yeah, that's really cool. And your brother, the fact that he works a corporate job and does like fills in gigs too, that is insane. Yeah.
That's like, I love it. He's like my lifesaver. I tell him all the time.
He's like living a double life, and the fact that you get confused as well is really funny.
He is definitely, for sure.
Oh, good for him. That sounds like a great life to live. I remember actually reading on your website that you joined the military after high school. What was that like?
So I initially went into the Army for college money. Right after high school, I graduated in 1999, and I was like, my first 3 years were amazing. It felt like essentially like an adult version of Boy Scouts. Like we, and then I could go, I was close enough to where I could travel home on the weekends. So I could like, it would take me 2 hours to get home. So I could see some of my friends from high school. There was like a couple different universities that were close to where I was stationed. So it was really great. The only time that it switches when 9/11 happened and I actually had to be deployed. That's when I was just like, I signed up to do my job, but I never thought I would actually have to do it. And so when I had to do my job, I was just like, this is not for me. So as soon as I had the opportunity to get out, I was just like, got my money, got my time, whatever the case is. Now I want to like actually go try to pursue music at a high level. Because even while I was still in the military, I still would play. And they would have like different soldier shows that would come through or different people that would perform. And I was always like, can I get myself like close to the stage and be like, hey, I kind of play a little bit. Do you guys think I could sit in? And so they'd be like, last song. So like the last song, whatever the case it was, I would sit in and everybody would be like cheering. And I just wanted that sensation. Cause I was just like, this is what it could be like. So yeah, that kind of like sparked, definitely set a fire underneath me while I was in the Army to want to get out and pursue music at a high level.
Yeah. Was it a talent show? I might've read that wrong, but were you a part of the talent show?
A talent show. Yeah. So there was one talent show in particular, where the grand prize was like $500. I wasn't really concerned about the money. I just wanted to have an opportunity to perform. So my particular MOS was a combat arm. So like we did more of the actual fighting on the ground. So my battalion sergeant major was like, "Hey, Sergeant Marshall, do not get up there and embarrass our unit." Like I said, man, we're going to win, bro. Like, what are you talking about? We're going to win. I was probably way more like confident than I should have been because my talent.
You got to believe in yourself, though.
Very true. Yeah. But my talent level at that time in my career was not anything to like write home about. Like if anybody would have heard me, like that was like a professional would have been like, "Bro, you were way too cocky to be thinking that you were going to win." Long story short, we performed in front of 2,000 of our peers and we did win. That was the moment that like made me feel like, you know what, there's something there. Because, you know, when you're in the military, everybody has a dream. Everybody has a goal that they want to accomplish. You know, me pursuing music was very far-fetched because there's not a lot of people that will make it, you know, and it's such a tough business. And it's almost like, you know, you're really like reaching for something that's not really obtainable. Like, and versus like, if you're like, oh, if I want to go to corporate America or work a job or even play professional sports, there's so many different avenues that you can do, but being a professional musician and actually like sustaining yourself, it wasn't really doable. So a lot of people were just like, bro, come up out of the clouds right now, bro. Like, find something that you can really do. Like, it's just like, you know, because we were combat MOS, they were like, work for the sheriff's department, get it, just have a nice life, get a house and be straight. But there was something like from that talent show that definitely sparked a fire in me to want to like go pursue music definitely once I got out. So that's what I did.
Wow, that's crazy. And the thing is about that, with people telling you kind of not to do it, like, it's really hard to make it in the music industry because talent really just isn't enough. Like, it full on is like a mental and physical game.
Definitely. So
in the years after that, when you decided like, this is like something I want to do, how long did it take and how hard were those years?
It took a long time, I'm not gonna lie to you. So when I first got out, I got out in 2007. Those years in Birmingham, I played on what is considered like the Chitlin circuit. It's like a Southern soul circuit. You're doing like more soul music. It's like, you still get to go to festivals, but they're not these big festivals that you get to see like on TV or YouTube. They're like smaller festivals. So it's like, you're still living your dream, but like, if that's like your ceiling, then like you'll feel like you're being successful. But for a person like me, I knew that there was more, because I could see on TV that like there's these big concerts and all these, I want that. I want to experience that. I want to play for a known artist. And playing in like kind of like the Chitlin circuit, the Southern Soul Market, I would say names of the artists that I was playing for, and people would look at me and be like, yeah, we know who that is. And you can tell like there's like, they just want to like appease you so they don't make you like feel like you're crazy. Yeah.
So I hate that feeling.
But that's a part of the growing pains. That's a part of like, you know, paying your dues. That's a part of you like cutting your teeth. So, and like, I believe it was like 2012, I did the BET Music Awards in LA. I flew out to LA, and while I was in soundcheck, there were other musicians that were happened to be like playing. They were like, bro, where are you from? And I'm like, I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. They were like, if you ever move to LA, bro, you'll never stop working. And that just kept like ruminating in my mind. It kept going over and over. Like, it was like a record that was on like repeat. So I went back home to Birmingham. I saved my money and I moved to LA. Now, mind you, when I moved to LA, I moved with roommates. It was extremely tough because the cost of living from Birmingham was completely different than the cost of living from LA. Birmingham, like, you could have an apartment, a 2-bedroom apartment, maybe like, I think at that time, maybe $700-$800. Wow. And like, you can live by yourself. You go to LA, it's like $2,000, $3,000, depending on where you live. And you could be in the hood and like, you got to have roommates in order to sustain yourself. So while I was there, my first 6 months were probably the most difficult because I wasn't making any money, having to like, you know, expend all my savings that I had saved that were going to last a year because I didn't understand what the cost of living was. So because the cost of living was so great, I was spending out more money than I was making. And it happened to be I was playing at a small Baptist church playing bass. And the MD for Tyrese was there at the church and asked, what was I doing like the next Thursday? And I said, man, nothing. He was like, you want to go to St. Kitts and play for Tyrese? And that's what jump-started my career in LA. Mind you, I've been going to every jam session. I was networking. I was playing like coffee shop gigs. I was doing all of the local stuff, but nothing. It kind of like stuck. I was getting some movement, but not enough to be like, I feel like I've made it. Like, I've kind of got like enough traction. So I definitely had to have a level of faith and a level of tenacity to know that like, I just can't quit. I gave myself a year. And I said, like, if it didn't work out in a year, I could always go back to Birmingham and do what I was doing before. So I gave myself a year. And right at the 6th, 7th month mark, that's when things started to turn around for me, to where I was just like, oh, I've made it. I've got a gig. I've got some, you know, some movement. Now I can kind of move from this point to make it kind of make more sense for me. So, yeah, that's really what it was like. But it was definitely one of those things where you're looking at everybody else and seeing them be successful, some of your peers. Mm. Some of the same guys that told me, like, move out here. And it's just like, they can't put me on, because what I learned was a lot of these gigs in these communities, it's a small niche community. And it's not always based off of talent. A lot of times it's like, do you fit the gig? Are you a cool person to hang out with once the show is over with? Because if you're on tour, I didn't realize how important it was to, like, to hang out with people. Because at first I thought it was just, you do your job and you go home. And so that was, a lot of people like, man, he's super talented. Kerry's super talented, but, like, he doesn't talk. he doesn't hang out. Like, I don't know if he would be good for this tour. So I was inadvertently shooting myself in the foot because I didn't know that you're supposed to hang out. So then I started to realize, because one of my friends took me to the side, he was like, bro, like, I'm just going to tell you this, man. Everybody knows you're super talented, but like, you always leave once you're done. You never hang out. So people don't know that you're really a cool person. They just think like either you're arrogant, you're stuck up, and that you don't want to be around them. And I was like, that's not it. Like, I was just trying to get home. And so understanding that, I shifted how I moved. And then once I started to hang out, people started to be like, oh, man, Carrie's like really cool. Like,
yeah,
definitely want to have him on the tour. So more things started to come in. So I started to realize that it's not just based upon talent alone. Like, you got to be a good hang. If you're not a good hang, then people still won't put you on the gigs, even though you may be the most talented person for the job in that room.
Yeah, it's so funny. So you're not the first person that's said that to me. Jamal Augustine, who I had on an episode a while back, he said the exact same thing. Like, you don't realize, but one of the most important things is how you connect and your vibe with other people. And it's not something you'd think about. It's not something like, if you're like, before you moved to LA, that wouldn't have been something that crossed your mind. But it's like, he said, it's literally is the most important thing is your relationship with other people while you're touring, because that's where you get like the opportunities from. And even me, before he said it and before you said it, like, it hasn't and wouldn't be something that I would have even thought about being something that was important.
You're absolutely right. I mean, nobody tells you this stuff before.
No.
Like, because when I moved, it's not like a handbook. They don't, as soon as you get into LA, they don't give you a handbook and be like, do these things and you'll be successful. It's kind of like you got to learn on the job or ask questions, or maybe you might, you know, just being around the right people, somebody may drop a nugget and just hear exactly what they're saying. Even I had to change like the way that I dressed when I was in LA, because in Alabama, like, we get to dress a little bit more dapper. You wear bow ties and kind of sweater vests and stuff like that. In LA, that's not the swag. So when I first went to like an audition for a pop gig, was one of the better guitar players there, but I looked like I was from Alabama. I didn't look like I was supposed to be on the tour or the show. So they were like, man, like, you would be great, but like, you got to change your image. And I could have taken it one or two ways. I could have been offended and been like, what do you mean I got to change my image? Or how I took it was like, okay, like, what should I do? They're like, dress like this, do this. And so I started to make the changes, and that again was getting me more calls. So I realized that like, people would drop nuggets. Some people would be offended to it. Some people would take offense to it. Other people like myself would just listen and learn from it and be like, okay, this is what I need to make the changes. If I'm really trying to do it at this level, this is what I need to do.
Yeah. No, that's crazy. So are you like naturally more of, I don't want to say a quieter person, but was it hard for you to get to the point where you were, I don't, socializing with other people? Because I personally, this is what, I've never been on a tour, but when I think about this, I'm like, I don't know if I'd struggle being in other people's company all the time. Okay. Was that hard for you? Like, was that something you had to train yourself out of, or are you naturally someone who's okay being in an environment with other people?
So I would say initially, like, prior to me going to the Army, I was very like introverted into myself. Being in the Army, you meet so many different people with different personalities, and you're kind of like forced into a situation where you all have to kind of coexist and cohabitate and like learn how to talk and realize that you have different backgrounds, but you have to find some sort of commonality in order to get along, because sometimes you're living together for like 6 months, 12 months out in the middle of nowhere. You have nothing else. So I have no choice but to kind of coexist. So what I did was when I first moved to L.A., I'm a very observant person. So I would just sit back and just watch everybody. So that's why a lot of times it's like you do your job. You know, it's almost like, you know, that blue collar mentality. You do your job, you don't cause any fuss, and you go home. You come back the next day, do your job, cause some fuss, and go home. So that's what my mindset was when I first got there, because I'm like, I don't want to get in any trouble. I don't want anybody to think that like I party too much, or like he can't control himself. Like, I do my job, I pack up, high five everybody. Y'all enjoy the thing, whatever. And then I dip out. But I, like I said, when it came to my realization that it was coming across a certain kind of way, I realized I had to change. So then I just realized I would start asking questions when I would hang out. Like, yo, man, so like, how did you guys enjoy the show? Like, that's when I started to find, like, when I would ask and engaging questions, it became easier to have conversation. And so what I would try to do, so I wouldn't feel so overwhelming initially, pick two people out in the crowd or whatever it is and just have a conversation with those two people. Have one with this person. Okay, like, give them 5 or 10 minutes. But make sure that everybody else is in the band that's out there can see me moving around and see that, like, oh, he's hanging out. Go find one other person. I may spend 15, 20 minutes, whatever the case is, stand around for a little bit longer. Like, I would give myself like maybe a 30 to 45 minute kind of cap. So I wouldn't feel like I was overly stimulated and be like that I'm really outside of my comfort zone until I got comfortable. And then when I got comfortable, it was just like it was second nature.
Yeah, it wasn't an issue anymore. That's such great advice, and that I'm going to steal that for when I'm in situations like that, because I do struggle. Like, you wouldn't think it doing a podcast and stuff, but like me being naturally introverted and thinking being in situations like that where you know, you got to show up and you got to be sociable and you got to, you know, talk to people. I'm going to use that. I'm like, I'll pick someone.
Yeah, give yourself small goals. I tell people all the time, give yourself small goals so you don't feel overwhelmed. Because if like somebody's like, you just got to stay here and hang out, you're just like, and I don't know, like how long? That's overwhelming. So if I'm like, I give myself like 5 to 10 minutes with like 2 different people and I just kind of float for like 25, 30 minutes, make sure everybody sees me. Like, all right, man, I love you guys, man. Listen, like, I had a great time. Like, I got to get out of here because I got such stuff to do in the morning. Even if I don't have such stuff to do in the morning, it's just like, oh, he's busy. He's got something to do. But we saw him hang out. He was cool. He hung out with everybody else, you know, so that way it's like oh, that person is a good hang. That way it just makes it like, it's just until you get your feet wet, you just got to do like just little steps, baby steps until you get there.
Yeah, you know what? That's such great advice. And I'm going to use that, not even in like music environments. It's when I'm like overstimulated in everyday life. It's like, that was like a mini therapist advice I've just taken from that, literally.
Definitely. It's going to help you.
Yeah. So when did theory come into the picture for you then? Was that something that you focused on while in church or?
Definitely. So theory came for me like kind of like my last back end of church in Birmingham before I moved, but more so after I got to LA. So I would be in church and I would hear the musicians, specifically the organ player, call out numbers. And I had a really good ear. I just had no idea what he was talking about. He'd like, go to the 2, go to the 5. And I'd just be like, I could hear the note and kind of be like, oh, I kind of know where that is because I kind of figure out what key we're in. Now, if we modulate it, I might be in trouble because I don't know where we're going. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was an area that I needed to pay a lot of attention to. Now, when I got to LA and I was really, really working, I would have like sometimes within the same week, a pop gig, an R&B gig, and then a hip hop gig, a lot of different music. So I was like, how can I remember all this stuff? Because I just can't remember it. So I stumbled upon the natural number system again. And then I realized how simple it was. And when I was charting out what song I was in, I knew what key. But if I wrote out the numbers, I could play along with the song until it got kind of from muscle memory, remembering where I was. That's what made me focus in on the number system and realize my workload sometime each week would oscillate depending on, sometimes it'd be a light load, sometimes it'd be a heavier load, but how could I remember and retain everything? The number system was a lifesaver. So I started to dig deep into it all the time and used it on so many gigs. I go back every now and then, look at some of my old boxes and I see like balled up pieces of paper with set lists and the numbers on the side so I can know like what key we're in, because it was a lifesaver. So the number system definitely made, it was like, I call it like my cheat code because it made playing for me so much more simple. You see me with my set list and the numbers on the side, count it off. I would know where we were and wouldn't have to worry about it versus like when before I had to think and be like, oh man, what's the first note? I don't even know. Like, what do we start on? And I'm like, I'm just paranoid. So yeah, it definitely made a huge difference.
Yeah, the whole memory thing is really hard. When you first started gigging, were you kind of not don't want to say over preparing because you can't really over prepare, but when you first were doing it, were you preparing a lot for it in comparison to say if you were to do a gig now?
I think I was preparing the wrong way. That's the difference. Okay. I didn't know what to listen for specifically. Like, what was my specific assignment? I didn't even know how to ask the right questions. I just knew that I was on the gig and these are the songs. So I think I was just preparing the wrong way because I didn't know specifically what my assignment was. Do you want me to play more rhythm on this song? Do you want to play more lead on this song? Do you want to do like more sounds? So I prepared, but I didn't prepare in such a way. It's just like somebody said to me, if you practice, but you're practicing the wrong thing, it's still an ineffective practice. And that's what I was doing. So now, because I understand the different assignments, I'll ask more questions. Hey, for this song right here, I hear that there's this guitar part. Or I hear that there's no guitar. Do you want me to just develop chords or do you want to develop a line? Like, what do you want me to do? So now I know specifically how to prepare versus in the beginning, I was just kind of like doing what I really wasn't doing whatever I thought. I just was just trying to learn the song and then trying to interject myself without knowing specifically what I'm supposed to do for certain songs. Mm.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's really interesting. So R&B is like my favorite genre of all time personally. And that's clearly, you know, a genre that you're very experienced in.
Right.
Who are some of your inspirations and why do you think R&B was and is the genre for you?
Okay. So growing up in church And like my parents were kind of like, didn't really allow us to like listen to a lot of outside music outside of church. R&B was the closest thing to it. So initially my first artist was like D'Angelo. So I heard D'Angelo. D'Angelo had so much church influence and Prince influence in his music. And I was like, man, this is funky. This is like soulful. It's like, oh my God. So it's just like, I could listen to it and not feel like I was straying too far away. So I would take some of the D'Angelo melodies. Like I remember Send It On came out and like we would have Offering, like we would have to play like music for Offering. And I started playing it. And everybody was just like grooving to it. I was like, they have no idea what I'm playing, but it's cool. So that's when I knew I had something. But from listening to D'Angelo, I started to like open up more genres of like seeing there's like, okay, there's neo soul. There's more like, you know, R&B groups. Like, you know, I remember 112, John B, Joe, all of these different artists were coming out at the same time, kind of doing Brian McKnight, doing a lot of the same kind of acoustic stuff. So I was just like, ooh, those sounds are really crazy. And it was like more guitar heavy influence versus like church, which was more piano and organ influence. So it's like, I felt like I had more of a prominence in the music. So definitely R&B started speaking to me in such a way that I felt like I could really like establish myself within the music.
No, I love that. I'm also an R&B absolute lover. You've also worked with some very well-known artists like Tori Kelly and Jason Derulo. What was the biggest thing that you kind of learned from your time with them? Is there any like standout moments?
So from Jason Derulo, I had the most time with him. I toured him for years and we literally went all over the country. Like I've got so many stamps in my passport from like working with Jason. I learned showmanship. I learned preparation for the gig. I learned like how to be, how you play in a festival is different than how you play like in a smaller room. So understanding like sounds, approaches, what kind of gear that you want to put on backline. I understood, I learned how to like work on a rider. I never had a rider prior to Jason. I didn't know what a rider was. I was like, a rider? What are you talking about? Like knowing what kind of, so I would have like different gear for different like venues. Like, or is it an outdoor festival? Okay, I need a Marshall JCM, like this whatever kind of amp. Or I need a Mesa Boogie rectifier. Or it's a smaller venue. Okay, I need like Mesa Boogie Longstar. Like understanding the kind of amps, understanding the overdrives that I needed to use for certain kind of venues. And with Jason, I learned like when you're playing on an outside venue, it's longer notes when you're soloing and not so many choppy notes because it gets lost in the crowd. So learning how to play better for better venues, I would say with Jason, and then learning how to have fun because that whole crew like had fun. I was really rigid when I started working with Jason and they showed me how to like loosen up and be like, yo, have fun on these gigs, man. Like it's, you're living out your dreams. Like I understand it's a job and, but like you have fun on these gigs. So Jason definitely helped me. The backstory with Tori was I actually met Tori while I was on tour with Jason the Isles of Malta. And we sat beside each other on the flight. So I was like, I leaned over. I was like, I said, I know you're Tori Kelly. I know you don't have any makeup on. But like, once we get to the venue, like after soundcheck or whatever, do you mind if I take a picture with you? And she was like, yeah, cool. Like years later, I wind up having to come in to work with Tori Kelly. But what I learned from working with her is she's everybody. Every artist has a different level of musicality. She's such an amazing talent. Her ear is very strong. So knowing how to support a singer with just like playing very lush chords and allowing them to do the work. Like you don't have to overwork. And I think a lot of times, and for some other situations, I work with singers that may not have been as strong. So I'd have to overplay a little bit to kind of like help support. But people like Tori, you just, it's like a wild horse. You just let them go. You don't have to like corner them, you know, like, cause she could go anywhere. And just understanding like how people have like beautiful spirits and like, you don't have to cloud it. Just let them breathe and let them whatever. So that's one of the things I learned with Tori. Tori really definitely allowed me to just have fun and really like learn more so of how to support really great singers. So.
Yeah. I mean, Tori is like, she was very much like, she blew up on social media. Really, I think everybody knows who Tori is. And there's this one iconic video of her and she's singing in the car. I think that was the video that kind of like, really blew up for her, but that is crazy. And that's really nice of you to say. I know you don't have any makeup on like when you're sat next to her, but when
I used to play for Letticy for years, and I remember Letticy would like, because our flights would be sometimes like crazy early in the morning,
yeah,
So she wouldn't wear makeup, and sometimes fans would see us in the airport and would like come up to her and ask her for a picture. And she was like, "I would love to give you a picture, but I don't look my best right now because you know they're gonna." So I knew based upon like how I would see Letticy respond, I was like, "Listen, Tori, I know you don't have any makeup on. I would love to take a picture. I know now is not the time. So whenever you get yourself, so like I think when I said that to her, that kind of like let her know, like, oh, he's aware. He knows what's up.
He knows he's on it. Yeah, that's so, another example of your observation skills.
Right. Yeah.
Definitely. Clearly, you're very observant. No, that's really cool. So when did YouTube come into the picture? Was this like a career move for you, or was this something you did for fun?
For fun. So I started YouTube back in my Birmingham days, and honestly, I was doing it for marketing. Again, I was playing on the Chitlin circuit, but I was trying to get myself known and seen by bigger people. Mm-hmm. I knew YouTube was kind of like the new wave of like, you know, when social media was kind of happening. So for me, which is an opportunity for me to get myself in front of other people. I didn't realize until like later on into my LA days that it could be used for a professional platform in teaching people. A lot of people would ask me for lessons, and I was doing the Skype thing for a long time, and it was just very strange to my career because I'd be trying to tour, but trying to break away and do lessons, and like depending on the time zone where everybody was at, it just didn't benefit that much. Mm-hmm. So I knew if I put it up on YouTube, it could last and it could stay there forever because it was like the new search engine with Google. So yeah. I was like, okay, I saw like when I got my team, they were like, yo, this is definitely like a new territory that's going to be around for a long time. Use it. Like, this is how you can use it. Because I didn't know how to use it at first. I thought you just put up videos and whatever. And I realized that you can use it as a platform to teach. You can gain a whole new audience by just working. Because there's a lot of people that just search stuff all the time. Mm. And if they're searching certain things, whatever they're looking for, your stuff could come up. And that's really how I started to use it as a professional, you know, tool for myself.
Yeah, it's really actually funny you say that because I started learning guitar at 13 and then there was a point where I was trying to take it a little bit more seriously and I was one of those people Googling on YouTube, searching on YouTube and yeah. I had been watching your videos before. So it's like actually a really cool, I'm like my guitar skills have gone literally in the bin, but there was a period of time where I was trying to obviously make it better.
Right.
You were one person of videos that I'd found that I used to watch. So it's like a cool full circle moment right. there. Yeah, that's really cool. And I don't even know. I remember us then connecting on Instagram, and that again was something that I thought back to. I was like, I literally used to watch his videos when I was trying to get better at guitar and sadly really failed, but that's fine.
But you're a phenomenal bass player. Like don't diminish that. Like,
thanks. You know what? Yeah. I do think I found my place there, and I think it makes sense me because I initially, like I said, wanted to play drums, and then eventually I found the really great like middle ground between guitar and drums. Where did Kerry's Too Smooth come from? Is there like a background to that, or is that just a nickname that you?
No, it was a nickname. So I used to play quartet, and mm-hmm. when I played quartet, I didn't move. I would just stand very stiff and still. So like, I think it was 14, 15, stand very stiff and still. And somebody was like, yo, who is that over there? And it's just like, oh, that's Too Smooth.
Oh, nice.
And it just kind of stuck. And so when I got mm-hmm. When I came back to Birmingham, I was working on marketing myself. And I was like, what can I use? It's like a catchphrase that everybody's going to know because there's a lot of Kerrys out there. Like my name is Kerry Marshall. So there's another famous painter and artist in Birmingham that used to paint. His name is Kerry Marshall, but his middle name is James. So I was like, I got to do something different so everybody doesn't think that when they go start to search, they see like, because I, even now I've had some people be like, man, I had no idea that you paint. I'm like, I don't paint. That's Kerry James Marshall. So that's where the Too Smooth really became like to differentiate from me and the other artists. So that's where I really started to kind of stick on the name.
Oh, no, that's really cool. Yeah, I that wasn't a part of my original questions. But then before we were doing this, I was like, wait, why didn't I want to ask him that? So where do you think YouTube as a platform is headed? Because I've been thinking about this a lot. Like I used to upload on YouTube, but now that we've got like things like TikTok and stuff, like I literally cannot think. I do think there's a lot of people that still use YouTube, but like when you think about how popular TikTok and stuff is, where do you think YouTube is going?
I think YouTube is going to be around a lot longer than like TikTok, Instagram, like all of those places. And I tell you why, because it's attached to Google. And things will live on the YouTube space a lot longer than TikTok will. And the reason why I feel like it's really important, I think somebody from my team told me that, like, I forget how often R&B guitar is searched daily. I want to say it's like 8 billion times.
Damn.
So if you think about that on YouTube, just on YouTube in general. Yeah. So that's why I feel like YouTube is definitely a platform. I feel like a lot of times you can cross-pollinate the same information that you put on TikTok, you can take it to YouTube. YouTube, you can take it to TikTok. So that's typically what I do sometimes. I just take the same information and just kind of cross-pollinate it. Or if I take it from Instagram, whatever the case may be. But I think YouTube will be around for a long time. And I think it will, like, it's like an archive of, like, valuable information that people can search. So it's... I think if people use it effectively and they remember that, I think they can definitely win in the long run.
Yeah, no, I do agree. YouTube as a platform is responsible for a lot of people kind of teaching themselves,
right?
Like instruments and stuff. Because when I started learning guitar, it was like, oh, I'd just search up on YouTube, like, how to play this song. I remember one of the first songs was All of Me. On my little acoustic, my acoustic guitar. I was like searching an All of Me tutorial. I actually think that probably was the first song I ever learned on guitar. But like people like me who constantly go back to YouTube as like an educational source.
Right. Even now, I'm the same way. Like even like for different little hobbies that I want to do, I go, the first place I'm going is YouTube because I know that somebody probably put it up and they can show me and they can explain it, how they did it, you know, so.
Yeah, I think the thing is about TikTok and the reason I asked the question is because a lot of people are saying now, because TikTok right now is so popular, that everything is now designed to cater to everyone's short attention spans. So when you compare like a YouTube video that will be like 8+ minutes long to like a TikTok that people are constantly watching that's like average 30 seconds to a minute, It does get really scary when you think about it because of how popular like Instagram Reels and TikToks have become because people's attention span.
Very true. This is the one thing I would say about that because my team, we talk about that. So we do specific stuff for TikTok and stuff for YouTube. The stuff that we do for YouTube, we've tapered off because we understand that like I think the watch time typically is like a minute, maybe 3 minutes. But the thing is like you have different age demographics that watch YouTube. So I think like as our generation gets older, I think some of the stuff on TikTok won't matter anymore. We'll still go back to YouTube because we know that we want to really know how to do something. So that's why I think that YouTube will always be around because it has stuff for every age demographic, regardless of whatever you need. And I think it can definitely relate. Unlike TikTok, like I think about my mom is like never getting on TikTok, but she's on. She's on YouTube. She's on Instagram. But like, when I think about some of my aunts or some of my uncles, like some of them are on TikTok, but other ones would be like, no, I ain't doing that stuff. So I think it like there's just certain pockets of people that it definitely can still reach. So,
it's generationally friendly and useful to everyone. No, I completely agree. And I think it will be around for a long time. I also hope it will be around for a long time because, like I said, it adds, in my opinion, a lot of value to people's lives. Like, I'm sure your videos have helped so many people and they helped me at a time, even though I didn't stick to guitar and quite questionable at it. I do remember your videos helping me. Was there ever a moment in your career where you thought that you weren't good enough and maybe struggled with self-confidence a bit? I know we were talking about how in the beginning when you're in the military kind of talking yourself up a bit, but was there a moment?
Yeah, plenty of times, especially in LA, because when I first moved to LA, like everybody was there. You go to these different auditions and you're like, how am I even supposed, I think I just want to like leave because there's so many guys, great guys and girls like lined up for these gigs. Or when you go in, you sometimes like there's two guitar players that have to audition at the same time and you're hearing the level of like skill and you're just like, there's no way in hell I'm supposed to be in this room. So there's plenty of times that has happened or like, how did I get this gig versus them? You know, or like the imposter syndrome or like knowing that thinking that you're not good enough or like, what am I supposed to do in this particular space? And I used to have to tell myself, like when I get a call for a gig, it was like, they called you for a reason. If you weren't good, they're not going to call you because they don't even know you. So why would they call you just to be like, oh, we want Carrie just to hang out? Like, no, they call you for a reason. So, yeah, there have been plenty of times in my career that I've had moments where I was just like, I didn't feel like I was good enough. I questioned my ability, like because the competition, I wouldn't even say the competition, like my counterparts, everybody was so skilled and talented that you'd be like, how am I supposed to sit in this room? Or even if you're subbing for a person, like they expect to hear it this way. Like, how can I, like, you know, hold down this spot, you know, for a certain kind of way. So there's been plenty of times, but you have to rely on it. Like, listen, I've been doing this for a while. No, nobody would have called me if they didn't feel like I was capable of doing this. And like, I have skills too. So that my skills may be different, but I have skills too. So just relying on that and remembering and reminding yourself of those things definitely has a great impact on like your whole mental state when you have those moments that you wrestle with.
Yeah, and pushing yourself out of your comfort zone, because a lot of times things feel uncomfortable and I have to constantly remind myself of this as well, even when not specific to music, but like the only way that you are going to progress and get over thoughts like that is being okay with being uncomfortable in definitely. The moment and challenging yourself. Yeah, I constantly do have to tell myself that. What about mistakes and stuff when you're like playing live? How do you navigate that?
I realize that everybody makes mistakes, and this is the one part. Even though you rehearse, there's still certain times that guys like will just have a brain fart. It just is what it is. The thing about it is like you own it, and you like you know, get better for the next one, and you try to make sure that like there's you don't string a bunch of mistakes back to back. Like you don't have a train wreck. It's okay. Like for the, you know, sometimes like a glitch where the train will kind of like shift on the track and be like, oh, okay, something happened where we're back on track. But not letting it be like too much. And then sometimes like I've learned to apologize to the group, be like, yo man, I missed that note on that, man. I never happened again. And the fact that I take ownership of it sometimes, they're like, yo man, I appreciate it, bro. I didn't even hear it.
Yeah.
Or the people I do hear will be like, oh man, bro, I appreciate it. Like, I'm gonna lock in and make sure I got a square day for the next time. And then sometimes, like even before, like maybe the next show, or whatever, I'll run that part just to be like, "Yo, is this? Am I playing around? I just want to make sure." And they'll be like, "Yeah, yeah, you're straight." Just to show that I put in the work, so they can see that I'm not just talking it. Mm. So that's how I kind of like work through mistakes. Mistakes will happen. As proficient as you want to be, sometimes you miss a note, or you didn't hear, or your ears go out, or whatever. There could be so many different complications that can happen, but it's all about what you do on the next part or the next play, whenever you're playing. So that's what I think about.
So how do you work through moments where you're struggling with creativity or like the motivation to practice? Because I know everyone goes through that at points.
I start listening to different genres. So for me, we'll go on Spotify and put in pop 2023 and start going through until something just hits me and I'm like, oh, what is that?
Yeah.
Like what, you know, like, and it may be 10 songs and it may be 5 songs and it could be 20. Like you never know, but just stuff like that. Or if I'll like see what's the most popular music that's happening right now, it might be Afrobeats. I'll put on Afrobeats playlist for 2023 and I'll just start listening to something that inspires me. And I'm just like, oh, okay, this sounds really cool. Country, whatever the case is, it doesn't matter. I'll find something. And typically Spotify is like my go-to. I'll do the same thing on YouTube as well, but we will find ourselves in ruts along this journey or plateaus because we play music all the time and we listen to it all the time. So it's just like, man, I want to do something different. So finding yourself listening to something different that may just kind of like just jolt you a little bit, help kind of jumpstart you, will definitely kind of push you to, because music is your love, it's your passion, but every day doesn't feel the same. So sometimes you got to find a way for it to kind of jolt you back into finding that, you know, reestablishing that vigor that you have for what it was. Like, oh man, this is really dope. I never even heard of this music before. Like, what is this? And that can happen for you.
Yeah. What's your opinion on country music? Have you played any?
So I've played some country gigs. For me, it's storytelling, but it's about like how you approach it. There's several different types of country music. Just like how there are even within R&B, there's like, you know, neo soul, there's like chill listening, like lo-fi, there's all types of stuff. So when it comes to country, I think that there are different, like various styles. I found myself really like falling in love with Chris Stapleton's voice. Like there's like a soulful texture to it, even though it's country. And like, you know, I've been around some people be like, bro, you listening to that? I'm like, bro, like stop and just listen to like his voice. Like I know his country music's got a cowboy hat on, but like listen to his voice. And they're like, yo, this dude is killing.
Yeah.
So I think like within the genre, there are a lot of gems, but I think a lot of times I've been guilty of like closing myself off because I'm like, man, that's country music. I ain't listening to that. I don't play like chicken picking, like whatever, but even some of the chicken picking stuff is cool, you know? So yeah. Allowing yourself to be open-minded about it definitely allows you to like have a different respect and appreciation for the genre.
Yeah, I completely agree. And what you said about storytelling in country music being incredible, it is. That's my favorite thing about country music. I do have moments where it gets me in my feelings like no other genre.
Yeah.
I like go to country music if I'm like feeling down. Maybe I want to cry a little.
Right.
Country music, like, there we go.
For sure.
So if you were to learn guitar all over again, what Ooh. Would your practice routine look like, and what do you think you'd prioritize?
That is a good question. I would focus in on learning the major scale and the minor pentatonic.
Mm-hmm.
I would learn the number system. And then I would learn different chord inversions. Then I would start to work on rhythm, like understanding like strum patterns and
ghost kind
of stuff. Because when it comes to a guitar player, our biggest thing is everybody wants you to have that. If you don't have that feel, and they can't really explain what feel is all the time, but they just know that you have. So it's like that's that rhythm part, like knowing how to like ghost note certain kind of stuff, knowing how to pick out lines. Those would be some of the foundational pieces that I would focus in on, and then just expand understanding the approach to like how to play guitar. Because a lot of people know the songs, they know the music, but they don't know how to approach it. Like understanding the dynamics and understanding like the ebbs and flows of how a song goes. Everything is not all the way on 10. Everything is not all the way always on 2. Knowing how to build up when you get to the bridge, or helping a singer kind of bring the song to a climax, you know, and then resolve, like understanding those different nuances. Those would be some of the things that I would definitely focus in on.
Nice. And if you were at the age again where you were learning guitar all over again, do you think you'd apply to like a music institution or a music school? Do you think you'd want to go to somewhere?
I think
like
so.
That?
I think having the information and knowing what it is. Now, when you go to these music schools and institutions, like a lot of them aren't necessarily set up for you to like go be a professional musician. They're just giving you the information. So it's just like you're learning like jazz there, you're learning whatever. So I would take that, but also be like, I would almost be like, when school is over, trying to find like the jam sessions to be like, yo, I this is what I learned in school, but how can I apply it for these jam sessions? How can I still hang out? So I would still definitely be like doing the underground thing and trying to figure out how to like, you know, learn how to play music that I appreciate, versus just understanding the overall concept. So let's say if I do happen to play at the Grammys or the Emmys where we have to read, I know exactly what that looks like. But if I want to get on stage and jam out with Jill Scott, I know how to do that too. You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm the same. I never went to any schools or anything like that, but I feel like if I had the opportunity to, again, I think I would as well. So I was like scrolling through your website as my preparation for this, and I noticed Kerry's Camp.
Yes.
Yeah, that looks like a lot of work has gone into a course like that, and I've heard you mention your team. So I'm assuming your team was helping you in the making of Kerry's Camp.
Definitely. So I'll tell you how Kerry's Camp, the inception of Kerry's Camp happened. I was supposed to be going on a tour with a very prominent artist. The artist did not like the direction that the musical director was doing. So she fired the musical director and hired a whole new music director. And he came in and was like, listen, you guys are great, but like you aren't my people. And it's no hard feelings. It's not personal. I just like to use a group that I've been accustomed to. So long story short, I got let go. And so I was like, oh man, how am I going to make money? I've really like depended on this tour. So I started giving guitar lessons, and my first business partner asked me, like, I think at that time, I think I maybe had like 20,000 followers. And so she asked, like, if 2,000 of your followers paid like $100 for a guitar lesson, how much money would that be? So I looked at the figures and I was just like, oh my God.
A lot of money.
Right. And so she was like, it's doable, but you have to build it. And so what we started to do was, she's like, just give me a year and a half and we can get it off the ground. So I worked diligently for a year and a half, having to, you know, being on a set, having a lapel mic, having to read a teleprompter, having to have specific, like, it was just a lot of work. Stuff that I was uncomfortable with, because I could teach you how to play guitar, but having to do like, hi, my name is Kerry Too Smooth, and this today, like, I didn't like that whole feeling like I was on TV or something. So it was just really weird and awkward. So the first maybe month and a half, my resistance was, I was like a horse, like you were trying to bridle a horse. I just, you don't put it on me. I hated it. So we got to a year and a half. I was in Paris doing a gig, but I was running low on funds. And so I asked my business partner, yeah, can we do a soft launch? And she was like, sure, we can see a soft launch, just kind of test the market and see where we are. I literally had maybe $1,500 in my account. I woke up the next morning and had almost 10 grand. Damn. That's when I was like, okay, this is something. So started listening to, you know, my team and my staff, and like what we did lifetime membership for like maybe the first 50 people. And those first 50 people were my beta group. They would tell me, this is what we want to learn, because what I was teaching was not necessarily what they wanted to learn. Mm. So having to realize that, like, you know, put my ego in check and be like, this is not what they want to learn. Teach them what they want to learn, because they'll keep buying if they want to learn specific things. So going back to the drawing board, redoing a lot of lessons and listening to them, having the focus group telling about like, well, we want live Q&A. We want to have interviews with other people that have been in the industry so we can have so started listening to all those things and started modifying and changing and morphed into Carrie's Camp. So now that we have, I think right now we have well over 500 students worldwide. Wow. And we're constantly growing. So we fluctuated in between like 800 students, 500 students, but like we roughly kind of stay around like 500 students roughly. But like we, like I said, we've expanded our team to where we can kind of compensate, and we can kind of like, we can really kind of like appeal to whomever we need to appeal, whatever the time zones are. So it's been really successful. It's to the point now where Carrie's Camp is probably more, not even probably, it's way more lucrative than me ever touring. Like I, as a musician, you don't really get a chance to like buy a house or to live a certain kind of way. It's like the lifestyle, unless you're playing with like a huge known rock band like U2, like Red Hot Chili Peppers. Like R&B, I love R&B to death, but like these artists are not like going to put you in a position where you could go, because yeah. Michael Jackson is no longer here. You're not making 40 grand. You know what I'm saying? Like that's just not happening. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, sometimes you have to like, you're working a day job, but you're also doing a night job. So Carrie's Camp allows me to not have to focus on anything else but music specifically. And I've been able to purchase like two homes. I'm able to live in such a way that it's comfortable. So when I go on a tour, I don't have to worry about the money per se. Like yeah. I'm not going on tour for free, but I don't have to be like, well, how much are we making? I ask the question, but I'm like, okay, we're making this much, but I get to have, if I love the music and I love the people, that's more so what it is. So Carrie's Camp has been a blessing, because not only has it like helped me financially, but it's also been a blessing and it's helped so many other students. Like some of my students, like are playing for like some of the well-known artists. Like I don't take full credit for Jules the Wolf, but Jules the Wolf plays for Justin Bieber, like one of the top pop artists in the world, you know, yeah. Like gave him lessons. So there's a lot of people like that have come from the community that are now starting to kind of like get their own places and kind of like make their own name, which is really cool. So that's what I've always wanted to do, because I remember how it was when I first started. I wanted to get the information from the guys that were on. And it didn't always work out because, you know, social media at that time was kind of new. People were like, who is this weird person reached out to me? So I said, whenever I get on, I get to a certain level, I want to give back. And so now to kind of see like that's happening, it's really phenomenal. It blows my mind all the time.
Yeah. So being kind of let go from that tour was a blessing, because it's now given you.
I didn't see it that way initially. I was mad. I'm telling you, I was like, what am I going to do? Oh. But yeah, it was a blessing in disguise. But sometimes rejection is redirection, because if I wouldn't have got rejected from that place, I wouldn't have got redirected to do what I'm doing now for Carrie's Camp. So for sure.
Yeah. And how long did it take you from that to doing your early release? Was it quite a while?
So let's say like a year and a half. I would say a year and a half, maybe 2 years, just kind of like we were testing it. But like, you know, like when you're putting out something of that magnitude, you want it to be as flawless as possible. You're not going to get everything, but you want it to be. So when you're running and people are starting to subscribe and you're not having a whole bunch of glitches, like, oh, the site is down or we're dealing with this. And people be like, oh man, I don't have any, whatever. So it took a lot of testing, which, because I'm an impatient person sometimes, was definitely testing for me. I was just like, oh my God, I'm just ready. So I had to be patient in the process. We got through a lot of growing pains, and we're still like, and, you know, we're revamping some stuff now. So like, hopefully by the end of the year, the site's going to look completely different from what it did, because we put it out in 2017. So now we've got to like update it, make it more modern, change some couple different things. And we got some other people working on our staff in order to make the aesthetic of it look really great. As also like having some new instructors to kind of help with the content. So it's just understanding like this part of what Carrie's Camp has really shown me as being a CEO, understanding what that looks like, having to pay everybody, having to ensure that things are right, that when you get money, you reinvest it. Like, you don't just get the money, you get to go live whatever you want to live. So I've learned a lot, even in that aspect of like what it takes in order to be successful. Because again, nobody really puts out a manual and be like, oh, you want to be a CEO? Here you go, read this book, and it's going to tell you everything you need to do, you know, so.
Yeah, that is crazy. So in terms of career then, is Kerry's Camp and making those additions, is that kind of what your focus is right now? Or are you more into the gigging? Or
I still love gigging. I don't want anybody to think I don't love gigging. Like, I just did a festival Sunday. So I still love gigging. Like, I just, I understand, like, my contingency is Kerry's Camp. And what I want to do is I want to be able to still have Kerry's Camp. And if I do get calls and calls happen, I can still go out. But me trying to chase the gig or go after like how I used to do, like when, especially back in my LA days, I feel like that's kind of morphed for me, because with music, especially in the industry and being in LA, like the aesthetic, they want like a younger guy to be on stage with, like, because a lot of these artists that are coming out are like new. They're like brand new. They're like maybe 16, 17, sometimes early 20s. I'm about to be 42. So like, not that I can't play the gig. It's just like, aesthetically, it's like, we don't want uncle or grandpa on stage playing whatever. And I haven't really got to the place where I wanted to do like be in the jazz space all the time. I love it, but I don't necessarily want to be in the, like wearing the white linen suits, playing jazz music all the time. But I know that that moment is coming at some point. So it's like, Kerry's Camp is kind of a way that I can still kind of go in between. Like, I can go do the R&B gig or the pop gig, but still come back and teach and not feel like I got to get the gig. You know what I mean? So if it comes across my plate, then yes. If not, then I'm still good.
I love that. Right. So this question is a question I ask all guests. It's a bit of a weird question, but I do like to try and tie to the title of my podcast. So if you had to choose a song that was essentially your soundtrack to success, or a song that you feel like represents you or where you are now, what song would it be? I know this is a really hard question to ask. It could be a song from church, or maybe something in the military. I don't know. What was the song you did for your, sorry, I've completely sidetracked your answer, but for that talent show, what was
it? It was a song that we made up. So me and my soldiers. It was a song we made up. But if I had to pick a song, I would say Never Would Have Made It by Marvin Sapp, Without You. Because when you listen to the song, how like my life literally I could have lost everything, but I never would have thought that I would have been in the position that I am without like God really orchestrating. I mean, I'm really big into my faith, because without it, I definitely could have made like a lot of the strides. Because leaving Birmingham, which is like home for me, moving all the way to LA in a space that I don't know anything about, I don't know the food, the culture, nothing, to try to get on to like play for a professional artist at the highest level. It's already so hard for anybody to make it, and to already like a kid from Birmingham to go over there and then like be able to like all the publications, all the placements with the artists. So yeah, I would say Never Would Have Made It by like Marvin Sapp would definitely be my soundtrack for sure.
Oh, nice. I love that you had an answer. I always feel really bad like asking people.
No, that's a great question though. You need to keep that one. That's a good question.
Yeah. See, I feel like when I came up with the name for the podcast and then I thought about this question, I was like, because I had different options for the name of this podcast, and it was between this name and another one. But then this one had that last question, and I was like, that's kind of a cool thing to be able to tie it back to the title. So definitely. I think that's what sold it for me. But thank you so much for taking the time and answering all of my questions.
Oh, no doubt. Like, I was a pleasure just being on, so thank you for asking me.
Yeah, no problem. And it's really cool to hear your story, because I'd obviously read a bit about it, but obviously wasn't fully understanding of it all. But yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're more than welcome.
Homeowners, if you're looking for the best in home security and smart home technology at a price you can actually afford, we have great news. Now you can get Vivint's award-winning home security systems starting at about $1 a day. U.S. News and World Report has recognized Vivint as the best professionally installed home security system of 2022. And right now, you can get Vivint's home security technology for about $1 a day. Plus, get free professional installation from a licensed technician. Protect your home and loved ones for as low as $1 a day. Call right now for your free home security consultation.
800-587-4281. 800-587-4281. 800-587-4281. That's 800-587-4281. Packages start at $29.99 a month with signed agreement. Restrictions apply. Speak to a representative for complete offer details. See Vivint.com for license details. Terms and conditions apply.
In times of economic uncertainty and chaos, your money means nothing. You may not even be able to get it from your bank or ATM. And the money you do have in the stock market will go down and down. What you can bank on is gold and silver. Gold and silver have been a reliable and trusted form of currency for thousands of years. Gold and silver have never been worth zero, and typically gold holds its value during economic turmoil. Call the Gold Hotline now and learn how to protect your money and your assets with gold and silver. And learn how to set up a new IRA or roll over your current one into a gold-backed IRA. Protect your money from the next market crash with gold and silver. Call now for your free gold guide.
800-557-7921. 800-557-7921. 800-557-7921. That's 800-557-7921.
If you served in the Marine Corps, by now you know about the contaminated water problem at Camp Lejeune. If you were stationed or worked at Camp Lejeune from 1953 to 1987, you probably have a lot of questions. We have some answers. You could be entitled to compensation. Billions of dollars are being allocated to pay for damages to anyone stationed at Camp Lejeune during that time. Unfortunately, it appears that officials may have known the contaminated water problem existed and did little to protect their men. The Semper Fi Code was not honored. If you or someone in your family has developed a serious illness, including various forms of cancer, call this Camp Lejeune legal support line right now. You can't turn back the clock and change what happened, but you can certainly call right now and learn your rights as a Marine. Here's the number.
800-485-5801. 800-485-5801. 800-485-5801. That's 800-485-5801.